Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Dr. Esselstyn is author of the best-selling book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, and he was featured in the hit documentary, Forks Over Knives. Dr. Esselstyn is a surgeon who has produced more than 150 scientific publications. He was the leader of a groundbreaking 20-year nutritional study that rocked the medical world. Many tens of thousands of people, including President Clinton, credit Dr. Esselstyn's research and nutritional advice with helping to save or radically improve the quality of their lives. So now, Dr. Esselstyn, my dad and I are so grateful for your decades of service to health and humanity, and we're so happy to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Dr. Esselstyn, for being with us.
What an honor to be with you two guys who have really set the pace for for so many years. This is wonderful.
Well, thank you. But still, there are a million heart attacks every year in this country, one every 30 seconds or so. Is it overreaching to say that we could end the heart disease epidemic in this country forever by changing what we eat?
No, I think that's right on the button. When you really look at the fact that, let's suppose that you were a cardiologist and you were going to hang out your shingle in rural China, the Papua Highlands in New Guinea, Central Africa, or the Tarahumara Indians in northern Mexico. We laughingly say, you know, you better plan on selling pencils because you're not going to see any cardiovascular disease there. It is virtually non-existent, and there is absolutely nothing quite as profound as to think of the fact that there are literally millions and billions of people on the planet who have never heard of this disease, which is absolutely not only taking the lives of so many men and women in America, but also it's totally taking us into debtor's prison.
The May 2014 issue of the Journal of Family Practice has a stunning report about a study that you've conducted and just published. Your earlier studies were criticized for being too small. The critics said that with a larger group, you would not get the same impressively high level of adherence that you've gotten with your smaller groups. But with this new study, you've put that really to the test. This new study reports the outcomes with a set of 200 patients. What are the results? Were the outcomes as good in these 200 patients as you had gotten with smaller groups?
What has occurred, actually, in these 200 is just as good, if not better. We found that in these 200 patients, all with significant cardiovascular illness, that 89.3, close to 90%, were adherent at 3.75, almost 4 years, with this type of whole food, plant-based nutritional lifestyle transition. And of all those who were adherent, 99.4% during that period avoided any further cardiac events.
That's astounding. And these were people who, absent the nutritional approach that you were treating them with, almost certainly would have had a number of serious adverse events.
Well, that's pretty well shown by the fact that the patients who were non-adherent, 62% had further cardiac events during that period.
62% of the non-compliance had further adverse events.
Yeah. You know, what was kind of crazy about this whole thing is that all we were doing was simply trying to echo back to the basic covenant of trust that has existed between caregiver and physician since the days of Hippocrates. And that is, wherever possible, the caregiver is going to share with the patient what is the causation of the illness. Now, sadly today, in cardiology, that is not being done. But what we were doing in this study was what we had done in our original study, namely, treating the causation of the illness, removing those delicious foods that were destroying their health, and exchanging them for another pile of delicious food that was restoring their health.
Dr. Bernadine Healy, the former director of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, has said that your focus on the healing powers of nutrition on diseased coronary arteries has now been proven right.
she was really a beacon for us right from the start. For instance, back in 1985, before I ever started this study, I just really wanted to get the feedback from Bernadine, who was at that time director of research at the Cleveland Clinic. And in going over this with her, she said, you know, you have nothing to lose. You can certainly give it a try, as this has really never been accomplished. And that was her comment at that time. And she kind of went on to become president of the American Heart Association, head of Red Cross, and also director of the National Institutes of Health. And in 2008, on a national public radio interview, Bernadine gave us further support when she was able to say that we had demonstrated a proof of concept. And I think that gave us really a feeling of scientific solidarity. And it's, to me, it's so incredibly exciting, because when you think about the fact that without drugs that have all these side effects and enormous costs, and without the morbidity and the mortality of these invasive procedures such as stents and bypass, which are absolutely pulling this nation into debtor's prison, we can end this really almost in a heartbeat if we could overcome some of the tremendous other institutions that are conflicted in involving themselves with this epidemic.
When we think about the institutional inertia, Dr. Bernadine Healy also said that the fact that your work had been proven to work raised another, what she called, unthinkable notion that heart patients can cure themselves. It seems incongruous to me that the idea that heart patients can heal themselves with dietary changes, an idea that has been proven by you and others to be true, would still be considered unthinkable to many in mainstream medicine.
Yeah, I think before we get too far here, I want to be sure that I make it clear that I have nothing but admiration for the compassion, the care, and the fund of knowledge of my cardiovascular colleagues. But Thomas Edison once said that dissent is essential for progress. And I think that it's going to be very important for those of us who are espousing a simpler approach to this horrible disease to be able to demonstrate this in a scientific, peer-reviewed fashion so that everybody can be comfortable with this approach. Now, the thing that has been exciting is increasingly we recognize that patients who are not in an emergency, patients who, let's say, have a demonstrated obstruction of some of their coronary arteries, they may fail their stress test, then often immediately they'll get an angiogram, and the angiogram will show some significant arterial blockages, and then they are informed that they are a walking time bomb. Well, now, there's no question that if I'm in the middle of a heart attack, the person I want alongside me is going to be a man or a woman who has great expertise with stents. They can save my life, and they can protect my heart from a lot of further damage. But on the other hand, with somebody where this is elective, we have seen time and time again that with these patients, those that are aggressively, totally adherent to plant-based nutrition, not only can they avoid the expense, morbidity, and mortality of these procedures, but literally they can heal themselves. And often, especially those who have chest pain or angina, you can see this happening in days or a few weeks. It's so striking and so powerful to them that when they see this happening, they suddenly realize that they have been empowered as the locus of control to halt and reverse this disease.
Cholesterol-lowering statin drugs like Lipitor are the most commonly prescribed drugs in the country and have been for many years. There are more than 215 million prescriptions written for them each year, which generates about $14 billion in revenue for the pharmaceutical companies that make them. Statin drugs are taken now by nearly one in four U.S. adults between the ages of 45 and 64, and by about half of those over 65. Recently, new guidelines were issued by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology that could, by some estimates, greatly further increase the number of people taking these drugs. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that we have to recognize the fact that now that statin drugs have been out almost 20 years, what was it, 1987, we're now beginning to see that there are a few bumps in the road. For one, some patients have so much neuromuscular discomfort that they simply cannot get up off the floor. And many are just so sore and uncomfortable in taking them that they find that within 2 years, actually about 50% of people will just stop taking their statin drug. There's no question that in patients who have had heart disease that there can be a benefit to the statin drug. I think there are still many scholars who question whether people should think about taking it simply to prevent themselves from developing that disease. That research has still got a ways to go. Then there are other side effects, such as isolated patients who have a fair amount of cognitive disorder. They'll drive out their driveway while they're taking statins and then forget where they live. And then there's the problem of a certain number of patients who take statins will develop diabetes, which is hardly something that we would want to see as an additional risk factor in somebody who already has cardiovascular illness. So there really is an enormous problem with relying on statins. And I think the thing that to me is the saddest of all are people who feel that they're safe with a certain cholesterol number. And if they take a gorilla dose of a statin drug, they are able to achieve a very handsome total cholesterol number. And that, therefore, they interpret as being a rationale for impunity in terms of they can eat anything they want because they have this drug holding their cholesterol down. And that is absolutely, totally a false sense of security.
There are voices saying that traditional heart disease protocols, which do emphasize lowering cholesterol, have it wrong. There are voices saying that cholesterol levels are not such a great predictor of heart disease as we thought, and that the real culprits involve things like inflammation, fibrinogen, triglycerides, homocysteine, belly fat, triglyceride to HCL ratios, high glycemic levels, all these things. What's your take?
Well, I think that the spectrum of problems that you've just covered all enters into the equation. My bias, I guess, is pretty much like a number of other experts who feel that where this disease has its absolute inception is when we injure the life jacket or the guardian of our blood vessels, which is that delicate single-layer innermost anatomical layer on the inside of the artery called the endothelium. And this is an absolute magic carpet because the endothelial cell manufactures nitric oxide, which is a molecule that really helps to maintain the integrity of our blood vessels and protect them. Nitric oxide, for instance, keeps all those cellular elements in our bloodstream flowing smoothly like Teflon rather than Velcro. Number two, nitric oxide is the strongest vasodilator of blood vessels in the body. For instance, when you climb stairs, the arteries to your heart widen, dilate. The arteries to your legs widen, dilate. That's nitric oxide. Number three, nitric oxide will inhibit the inflammation from forming in the wall of the artery and keep it from becoming stiff and thickened and protects us from hypertension. And number four, nitric oxide can, in normal amounts, protect us from developing blockages or plaque. So our thrust by using this whole food, plant-based type of nutrition has been to remove all of the foods that every time they pass our lips decimate and injure the capacity of our endothelial cells to make nitric oxide. And this is, I think, very powerfully demonstrated when you look at the autopsies of our GIs who died in Korea. 80% of those 20-year-olds already had gross evidence of coronary artery disease that you could see without a microscope. Not enough for them to have a cardiac event yet, but there is the disease well on its way, and it's not a surprise that when people continue to ingest these same foods through their 20s, 30s, and 40s, now we begin to see the clinical cardiac events. As a matter of fact, that original Korean War study was repeated 45 years later in 1999, this time looking at young women and men between the ages of 17 and 34 who had died of accidents, homicides, and suicides, and they found now that the disease is ubiquitous. So you graduate from high school in this country, you get a diploma, and you also get the foundation for heart disease. I think we can do a lot better.
I agree, and you and others like Dean Ornish, who's another speaker in the Food Revolution Summit, have been demonstrating compellingly that impeded blood flow is a condition that can be reversed, and that arteries that have become clogged and narrowed literally open up again when people adopt a low-fat, whole foods, plant-strong diet. Meanwhile, speaking of nitric oxide, erectile dysfunction, commonly, of course, called ED, affects something like 30 million men in this country. Is there evidence that the dietary changes that have been proven conclusively to open up the arteries feeding the heart can resolve ED problems by opening up the arteries feeding the penis?
No question. First of all, we know that the size of the penile artery is much, much smaller than the coronary artery to the heart. And so it's not terribly surprising that sometimes, long before somebody comes down with heart disease, they'll find that they are no longer able to raise the flag. But all is not lost, because not infrequently, 10 or 12 months after I've counseled somebody for heart disease, I may get a phone call, and they'll say, "Dr. Esselstyn, yes, I thought I ought to give you a call, because recently something has come up, and I wonder if I don't owe you another check." So, yes, it can be reversed.
If a man's problems with ED are caused by blood pressure medication rather than by cholesterol issues, would his condition still improve from eating the diet you advocate?
Well, I think we have to find that out on an individual basis. But certainly if the type of plant-based nutrition is beginning to control their blood pressure and they can be gradually weaned off their blood pressure medication, and then at the same time continue with plant-based nutrition, I think they have now afforded themselves an optimal state in which to restore erectile capacity without having to take a lot of medicine and have other side effects. And at the same time, they're more or less licking two diseases, as it were, at one time.
Which seems like common sense, and yet I know that there are people who read your book or watch Forks Over Knives, and then they go to their doctors. They're excited. They want to talk about adopting the diet you advocate. But sometimes their physicians will dismiss the idea. Why aren't more doctors and dietitians, for that matter, telling us about it, or at least giving it serious consideration?
Well, it's interesting. I think there are a number of answers to that. One is it's interesting that in Cleveland, now we've had a number of cardiologists, when they've come down with a heart attack or heart disease, come to see us. And we'll counsel them, and they're very excited about how they turn out. And then they go back, but they don't usually refer us patients, because it's really a challenge to have physicians adopt something for which they, A, never have had any training. Physicians don't get training in nutrition. B, physicians feel very uncomfortable, many of them, with knowing how to instruct patients in behavioral modification. This is something that is a special interest to physicians who have this interest and capacity. Then there's, at the present time, physicians are not being compensated from an insurance mechanism for this type of activity. And it's very hard to have physicians develop enthusiasm for an activity for which they will not be compensated. But
I think what will
eventually come about is, like so many things in medicine, that the absolute hard science research and outcomes are getting to the point where it's just about hard to refute this. And it's always interesting when I have an opportunity to present our data at an academic community, you can just often see several of the younger people really getting excited about this, and I just know what's going to happen.
Well, we want to see it happen as soon as possible because there's a lot of people suffering, and that suffering could be abated and in many cases prevented by the kinds of changes you are convincingly demonstrating work. It's kind of ironic to me. I know you grew up on a cattle farm in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And
here
you are, one of the world's leading proponents of a diet that does not include meat. When you look back on your life, what were the important turning points that guided you onto the path you've taken?
Well, when I was in medical school, I somehow decided that the way to get things done was through surgery. I mean, you could repair the hernia, you could take care of the bowel obstruction, you could move an inflamed appendix, you could remove an inflamed gallbladder and gallstones, you could operate on stomach ulcers. If it was a tumor, you could remove the tumor. So I ended up going into surgery, and I left my training at the Cleveland Clinic to go into the Army for 2 years, had a year in Fort Bragg and a year in Vietnam as a combat surgeon in 1967 and 68. And when I returned, I was asked to join the staff of the Cleveland Clinic and the Department of General Surgery. My duties there came to include chairmanship of the Breast Cancer Task Force and head of the section on thyroid and parathyroid surgery. But really, it was as chairman of the Breast Cancer Task Force that by the late 1970s and early 80s, I became increasingly disillusioned with the fact that for no matter how many women I was doing breast surgery, I was doing absolutely nothing for the next unsuspecting victim. And that led to a bit of global research, and it was quite apparent that there were a number of cultures where breast cancer was 30 or 40 times less frequent than in the United States, such as Kenya. And if you looked at rural Japan in the 1950s, breast cancer was very infrequently identified. And yet as soon as the Japanese women would migrate to the United States by the second and third generation, still pure Japanese American, they now had the same rate of breast cancer as their Caucasian counterpart. And perhaps even more powerful was the fact that if you looked in 1958 at cancer of the prostate in the entire nation of Japan, how many cases were identified, autopsy proven? 18. Now, that was really pretty mind-boggling. And by 1978, 20 years later, they were up to 137, which still pales in comparison to the 28,000 who will die in this country. So at that point, I somehow had the feeling that my bones would long be dust before I could really get the answers between nutrition and cancer, although in hindsight, I'm not that sure. But nevertheless, that was when I decided that in view of the fact that there were many cultures where heart disease was virtually non-existent because of plant-based nutrition, if we could get people to eat plants to save their heart, then they would at the same time, in all likelihood, be protecting themselves from the common Western cancers of breast, prostate, colon, and pancreatic. Now, it was one thing to have that conviction. There were two other books that I read about the same time that helped me along the way. One was by Nathan Pritikin, and the other was John McDougall's McDougall Plan. But I just knew I was going to do this, but I was in that awkward situation of behavioral modification myself, because here I was, a cholesterol-holic, had grown up on an Aberdeen Angus beef farm, and I loved all that awful food. And I was at a surgical meeting in April of 1984 in New Haven, Connecticut. And let's just say that the papers at that meeting were not very sparkling. And the weather was just terrible. But as always, they have a banquet at these affairs. And that evening, when the waitress put a plate in front of me with roast beef, the roast beef was draped over the sides. And I just looked at it, and that was my epiphany. And my wife, who was there with me, said, "You aren't going to eat your roast beef?" I said, "No." And she said, "Well, and I'll have it." Well, actually, my wife, Ann's mother, had died at age 53 from cancer of the breast. 2 weeks after that meeting in New Haven, her sister came down with cancer of the breast. She then looked at me and said, "I'm with you." And so it was in 1984 in April that was the last time I had any meat, chicken, fowl, or so forth. Must say, since then, there's been an occasional slippage with a little piece of salmon. But by and large, that's the way it's been.
And, well, that's 30 years now. And you are, I believe, 80. 80 years old.
That's right.
And I have seen you recently, and I know you to be the very picture of radiant health. Your Ann Sunrip is one of the country's foremost advocates for the diet you've developed and also a world-class athlete. How did your family first transition to a plant-strong diet? I get that 30 years ago you and Ann made this shift. What about your kids? Did you
all make the switch together? Well, it's interesting. The only child that was still at home then was our 17-year-old, and he scratched his head and wondered what in the world we were doing. But he actually came along, and so did the others who had already left the nest, shall we say, as the data began to pile up and they increasingly understood about the benefits of this. Because, let's face it, their grandfather, my dad, had his first heart attack at 43, and by his mid-60s he had developed type 2 diabetes. Then it was prostate cancer that was metastatic and took his life at the age of 72. Which really, my dad was sort of a living fossil of the ravages of Western nutrition, as were many members of my wife's family. So once the kids understood this, they've all come on board, and they've been wonderful advocates for this, as have their children.
And that's tremendous. You and your work are featured now in the wildly successful documentary Forks Over Knives. Many people have had their first exposure to, introduction to your work through that film. It's having a tremendous influence over millions of lives. Is there a next step for that film or a follow-up or some other way that you have of further flourishing that development?
Yeah, I think it's through people like Ocean and John Robbins. Yeah, who were so wonderful about trying to really get this information out there, because you're absolutely right. What it does come down to is education. I will just take a moment and share with you what we do at our intensive counseling seminar at the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute, where I work, because you're probably wondering, or your listeners might wonder, how in the world can he say that he gets 89.3% or close to 90% adherence with these patients? And I will just share with you a couple of thoughts. One is that I think if you're really going to get a patient to do what you're asking, you have to show them respect. And the only way that I know to show a patient respect is to give them our time. And we do our counseling with no more than 10 or 12 parties who, by and large, come from outside the state of Ohio with their spouse, who we insist comes, and they come for free. And then my secretary will give me a list 10 days before our intensive counseling seminar, all those who are going to be attending with their phone numbers, because I have to call each of them myself over the phone first for maybe 15 or 20 minutes, whatever it takes, for me to get my arms totally around their story. And at the same time, they have an opportunity to ask questions of me on the phone so that we have a strong platform for when they come to the intensive counseling seminar. And at the seminar itself, it's 5.5 hours. It's one single day. We can't ask patients to come to Cleveland from Oregon, Texas, Florida, or Kansas for days at a time. But for 5.5 hours, they're going to first learn exactly what it is that they did, how they were able to so sufficiently trash their endothelial cells that they didn't have enough nitric oxide left to really to protect them, and all the background information we can give to them with a vocabulary so that they can understand, so they can really understand why it is they developed the disease in the first place, and also how then they, as the locus of control, can be empowered to halt and reverse this disease. Then we also give everybody a very hefty notebook, and in that notebook is a copy of every one of my PowerPoint slides, several of our scientific articles, a 44-page handout that has many additional recipes that combine with the 160 which are in my book, which we include. And then we have a wonderful hour and a quarter presentation from a woman who's had 29 years' experience acquiring and preparing plant-based dishes, dealing with reading ingredients, dealing with restaurants, dealing with travel. And then everybody receives a DVD of the entire counseling seminar that we filmed from an earlier one. So that should they go home and get a little rusty or forgetful, they can flip this on and bring themselves back up to speed. then we always have one or two persons who are local or regional who have had a previous successful experience share their story with the group so that those who are in attendance can say to themselves, listen, if he or she can do this, I can do this. Then we have a delightful plant-based luncheon, answer questions, and then stay in touch as necessary either through email or phone call.
Well, I know that Bill Clinton did not attend one of those seminars, but he did read your book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, and he is one of the hundreds of thousands of people who have been helped by your approach, and he credits you publicly when he speaks about his changes and the weight he's lost and how much better he feels. He's probably become the world's most famous vegan. Have you discovered anything new in recent years that has surprised you?
Yeah, I think that the thing that we have changed since the book would be the following. Since inasmuch as the patients that I see are already sort of riddled with disease and they have plaque, if I can get them to understand that their plaque is an absolute cauldron of oxidative inflammation, that what we really want are antioxidants to bathe this inflammatory situation. By that I don't mean go down to the health food store and buy a jug of pills that says antioxidant, because not only will that not work, but it's probably going to be harmful. I want them to use natural antioxidants from food that have are what we call high in ORAC value, O-R-A-C, oxygen radical absorptive capacity. An example for that would be in breakfast, raspberries, blueberries, and strawberries on the cereal. Wonderful. But the champ of all time are the green leafy vegetables. And my preference for these people, especially those who've got significant chest pain, angina, and what have you, is to try to get them into the habit of eating a green leafy vegetable six times a day. By that I mean, let's say it's the size of your fist after it has been cooked for 5.5 to 6 minutes in boiling water so it's nice and tender, and then it can be anointed with several drops of a delightful balsamic vinegar. So it's really tasteful. You do this at breakfast. Again, it is a mid-morning snack. Obviously, again, with your luncheon sandwich. A mid-afternoon snack, obviously, again, at dinner time. And I adore it when they have that evening snack of kale. What you are doing is all day long, you are absolutely anointing this cauldron of oxidative inflammation with these powerful natural antioxidants. And it really has helped accelerate the resolution of this illness.
You're talking about greens, and you mentioned kale. What are the other
I'll give you a few. Bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, collard green, beet greens, mustard green, turnip greens, napa cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cilantro, parsley, spinach, and arugula, and asparagus.
It sounds as though you have recited that litany before.
You got that right, John.
Well, at this point, Dr. Esselstyn, would you say that the biggest obstacle to the adoption of a whole food, plant-based diet is not in the lack of evidence, but in the lack of public awareness about the evidence that already exists?
Oh, I would totally agree with you. There's no question that now the data are out and they're so compelling. And what to me is so exciting is at our intensive counseling seminar in the last several years, we've had an increasing number of nurse practitioners and physicians who have come because they've been interested in learning what it is that we do, and they have taken this to their own practice. I think that as this sort of activity increases, there's going to be a tremendous amount of excitement. And there are some closed insurance plans that have suddenly, I think, begun to see the light. And that is to say that if they are finally, instead of offering their patients these expensive and dangerous procedures, the stents and bypasses, when electively and safely, and I think I want to emphasize that, and safely, they can be offered the alternative of not having these procedures, there is going to be enormous savings in that insurance situation that, when observed by other insurances, suddenly they will be copied. If money is what seems to be stalking so much these days, then if we can get that stalking for this movement in the right direction, then we're going to see a lot more rapid results.
I believe we will, and when we do, we will look back at your leadership with tremendous gratitude, which I already feel. You're an inspiration to me. It's a privilege to know you as a personal friend and also to appreciate the tremendous significance of the work you've done and are doing. And I want to thank you, Dr. Esselstyn, for your wisdom, your clarity, your compassion, and your courage, because you have been a pioneer here. You have stood out and stood up for this approach and proven it to be effective and safe when other people were holding back and not thinking it was possible, not thinking patients would comply or you know, actually do it. And you've shown that they will, and that in doing so, they get tremendous healing benefits to their whole lives without the risks that typical cardiovascular intervention procedures carry. So to me, you're a hero, and I thank you deeply from the bottom of my heart and on behalf of really of all of the human community that can benefit from your work.
We've been talking with Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, author of the bestseller Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, a leader at the Cleveland Clinic and a leader in the movements to reverse heart disease and to create healthier lives for all of us. Dr. Esselstyn, your work has saved thousands of lives, and the implications are that it could literally save millions. You've spent most of your 80 years researching and educating and empowering so that we could take the advantage of the learnings of medical science and have the health that we want and deserve. And I am so grateful to you, as are our listeners. It's been a privilege to share this time with you. We thank you for your service, for the love underneath it, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Well, thank you, Ocean and John.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get these members-only courses and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. If you'd like to express your responses to what you've been hearing, or to share your takeaways or reflections, or if you'd like to find out what other people are saying at the end of this first day of the Food Revolution Summit, please post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. You'll need to refresh the page in order to see the most recent comments. You can also engage and spread the word from our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/foodrevolutionsummit. This concludes day one of the summit. We are so thrilled that you are with us on this exciting, momentous event in the future of food, and we hope you'll come back and join us tomorrow for some powerful presentations. We're going to be hearing from Saru Jayaraman on what really goes on behind the kitchen door in restaurants, Amy Goodman on Food and Democracy Now, and Dr. Raj Patel on Eating for an End to Hunger on Planet Earth. So please come back and join us tomorrow. We wish you health, happiness, and lots of good food.